Hello, I'm Luai Al-Jundi and you are watching the Arabic Hour.
So it seems rather remarkable that all these examples where refugees are allowed to return to their homes historically for you know, as long as we have recorded history, but for some reason Palestinian refugees are excluded from that kind of right.
On today's program, we will have a documentary produced by Alternate Focus entitled Palestinian Right of Return. But first, our main feature, an interview with Dr. Maria Khoury of Taipei from Occupied West Bank Palestine. Dr. Khoury has appeared on this program often discussing living conditions in Palestine and her efforts to fundraise for a vital housing project in Taipei aimed at helping families obtain their first home on land donated by the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate. The project is also aimed at stemming the emigration of Palestinian Christians from the Holy Land. Dr. Khoury has written a series of books centered around a young girl named Christina who journeys to the Holy Land and who explains Orthodoxy to the young readers. The proceeds from the book are contributed to the housing fund. Dr. Khoury is interviewed by our own Dr. Elaine Agobian. Elaine?
Thank you. Today we have with us Dr. Maria Khoury. She is from Taiba in Palestine. Her husband is the mayor of Taiba. We have her here to speak about some of the projects that she is doing. But first, we'll start with looking at things on the ground, especially from the point of view of the mayor and his wife. Welcome, Maria Khoury.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what you do as the First Lady of Taipei, and what kinds of problems do people come to you with daily?
Well, actually, being in such a small little village and without an appropriate government and without any laws and order, we basically have our home open from morning till night, and my main job is serving coffee and tea to most people that I know. Mm-hmm. But because there is no law, there is no order, when someone has a problem, usually they come to the church or they come to the mayor's office, to the municipality, to get help with problems that have to do with their neighbors or with their families or with their lands and their properties.
Can you give us a few examples? But first let me just tell our audience that in fact Taiba is the only remaining all-Christian village in Palestine, and so you being the First Lady, so to speak, receive a lot of these people, not only just for coffee and tea, but obviously they come to talk and to ask for specific kinds of things. Can you give us an example of real people and what they have said to you about some of their needs?
Yeah, I think the major problem that we have there are very high unemployment. So of course, being in a land where we live under occupation and where the economy is completely collapsed, where we have over 50% unemployment. Our town has less than 2,000 people that live in Taipei, but we have deep roots going back 2,000 years, being Christian village. Now, of course, it's the only village that's 100%. The landowners are of Christian faith. So out of 4 million Palestinians that live in the West Bank and Gaza, less than 2% are Christian. And we're working very hard to try to keep this small little population in our village of Taipei, basically with the basic needs that they have, which are jobs, education, housing. These are just some of the very basic things that people need in order not to move away, because we have more people from Taipei living in Detroit, Michigan, and in Guatemala than Taipei itself, because over the years, the terrible wars, the checkpoints, the collapsed economy, the oppression, the occupation, it's forced people to leave for a better life.
And Christians tend to leave more because they have overseas contacts. and our relatives in some place, and so it makes it easier for them to leave. But give us an example of a specific person coming to you and with a specific problem, and let us share this individual's life for a moment.
Well, a lot of people come knocking on the door, especially let's say when their child is a senior in high school. We have mm-hmm. the Taujihi system there,
yes. called,
and the person wants to graduate and pass the general exams, and if they get a good score, they can get into one of the universities, and even the university might be not $40,000 like it is here to go to Boston University, but as little as under $2,000 a year for tuition at Bethlehem University or Brzezinski University. But when we're in this kind of location in the West Bank, even the $2,000 a year is a burden for any normal average family because of the low income also that people make. So even if the person, the parent is a teacher at the Orthodox school or at the local Roman Catholic school, we're talking about a salary that would be less than, you know, $500 or $600 each month. So people make very low salaries to the point where it's so difficult to afford tuition every year.
And I know you do some work in this area, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. Tell us, if you can, I mean, your husband has opened up a microbrewery of beer, and in a sense he's employed people, and it's been a big hit in your area. But how else can he, as mayor, create jobs?
I mean, right.
When you have a wall, when you have a Palestinian Authority that is not functioning,
yes.
When you have these checkpoints and so on,
we're completely surrounded by the wall, and so this affects employment where people used to work inside Jerusalem. Where since 2000, of course, this has not been possible. This is part of the high unemployment that we have, and we've tried very hard to write proposals to bring projects in the village, because the only kind of jobs that we could create are if we build a new multipurpose room. If we build anything, really, this would give jobs to people that work with construction for a short period of time. So we've worked very hard to try to bring projects into Taibe, but unfortunately, the only thing we have been able to do since my husband became a mayor is to use our good name of Taibe Beer, the beer company that my husband developed right after the Oslo Agreement, when we did return to Palestine to boost the economy by the investment in a microbrewery. We tried to use our good name of Taibe Beer to entice people to come to the village for a village festival. And once people come in, they will buy the oil that the women cooperatives make, they will buy the honey, they will buy the embroidery, and of course the gentleman that sells falafel will sell more falafel that mm-hmm. day than he will the whole year. So for 3 years now, in a very
Oktoberfest that you put on,
we've had the village festival, the Taibe Oktoberfest, which has gained great international media and recognition, and we've brought thousands of people into Taibe. Those 2 days of the Taibe Oktoberfest.
Who comes to the Oktoberfest? Is it international community, because Palestinians find it hard to travel, and also they don't have a lot of money to spend.
Right. So usually,
who comes into these?
We try to advertise to internationals that are working in humanitarian organizations. Advertise to the ambassadors and to the consul generals that have their staffs from different countries, and also would have the foreign passports that will allow them to go in and out of checkpoints. So our participants are local people, of course, but the diplomats and the professionals that work in different humanitarian organizations actually receive the high salaries that could afford the products, the mm-hmm. local products mm-hmm. that we try to promote, Taibe local products, in the Taibe Oktoberfest.
And by the way, your husband has created a situation where he helps to bottle the oil?
What we found out, since we did have an import and export license with our Taibe beer, since 2000, the local farmers were stuck with their olive oil because of the complete closure and siege on the Palestinian territory. So we diversified and bottled Taibe olive oil to help the farmers get the olive oil out and give them hope to return to their olive trees and for the next harvest have hope to work again and to cultivate the olives.
Let me turn to another aspect of life in Taibe, and especially under occupation and with a wall surrounding you. How do you deal with the issue of housing? I mean, if you have people who are unemployed and they can't afford much of anything, yet they need housing. You have almost single-handedly established a project, the Taibe Housing Project, to build homes for such people. But tell us first about the project and how many lives has it affected so far, and have you been able to be successful in the fundraising considering all the restrictions that you have to face?
Yeah, well, you know, throughout Palestine, one of the most basic needs as well is housing. And we live in a country also where it's difficult to get, there's no such thing as having, you know, a mortgage or having a loan. And if people don't have the $50,000 up front, they simply do not build a home. And so it's a lifetime kind of a saving and a lifetime dream for people to own their own home. So in our Church of St. George, Greek Orthodox Church, we had at least 30 members that didn't own land, that didn't have a first home, and were in need of a home. And all around us in other villages, we saw the great work of the Protestant faith and Catholic faith, really kind of fundraising and building homes for their parishioners and giving homes to Christian families to help them and to alleviate this burden of saving for a whole lifetime to have a home. So we started a project where throughout churches in the United States, people could donate to help build homes, and we couldn't raise the $1 million that it required for 30 homes, but through the metropolis of Boston, where the collection
Greek,
point,
the
Greek Orthodox metropolis of Boston, which was the collection point for the Taibe Orthodox Housing Project, since 2000, people have been sending donations. Up to this point, we've only raised $122,000. So it's very small money, but this small amount of money helped us get started, and we've built 12 skeleton units. So it's 6 buildings, but there's a home on the left and a home on the right for the 12 families, since we didn't have enough funds raised to help all 30 families. But of mm-hmm. course, we hope the project will continue, and we hope people will continue to support this very basic need of housing in our village, because if people have a roof over their head, if we're able to create jobs, if we're able to help them with their education, educating their children, hopefully we will keep our small community there, because this is mm-hmm. what we're suffering from, becoming such small numbers. And so even if we are small, we just want to try to help the people that are there continue to stay there.
You're also concerned about educating young people, and you have a new project which you're working on. I mean, you're sort of multitasking in terms of projects. You're amazing. But tell us about the education project and where people can contribute.
The new project is trying to help create an endowment fund for education. So this is just a small brochure that we send to people when I come to do presentations mm-hmm. about the Holy Land and about our village of Taibe. And this endowment fund was created with our sister church in Virginia, the Annunciation Cathedral in Norfolk, Virginia. And instead of the donations that we get immediately giving them to students, we thought if this money is saved and each year the net interest, the profit, the interest from the investment would come to Taibet. This would help, even if we help one student each year, it's better than what we have now. We started the endowment fund for my first book tour in that area with $5,000. Now it's grown to $10,000. But we hope when this endowment fund gets to be at least $50,000, that would generate enough interest for the one student for the annual tuition at Birzeit University or Bethlehem University. This kind of program that we started to help students pay for their tuitions locally is again to give people hope that they can get help inside Palestine to go to local universities, so also the Palestinian institutions can be supported so that they don't think of going abroad. So hopefully the job market can get better if, you know, peace and stability could ever come to Palestine. This would help.
Well, let's talk about peace and stability for a moment. My reading of the situation is that the Israeli policy, the Zionist policy, if you will, from its very beginning, was focused on trying to empty the land piece by piece of Palestinians, or at least a significant number of them, so that there is always going to be a majority-dominated Jewish state. And though they started with the area they got in the 48 war, the occupied territories, as you know, have settlements and so forth. And you have now a population of 400,000 plus settlers in the occupied territories. The whole Oslo process was almost a kind of interruption or a new experiment in the tactic of the Zionists to control the area. And that is that the assumption was Palestinians would police Palestinians. And Arafat in the end didn't sign and didn't want to play that role. And now you have Abbas practically begging to be a part of some peace process and is, in a sense, ignored in spite of an occasional meeting for show. And so what has happened is there almost seems to have been a return to a kind of war on Palestinians. And with this, you know, we see the incredible violence, not only in Gaza, not only there, but also in the West Bank. What are people saying about the possibility of peace? Do they even talk about it anymore, or are they aware that for the long future, unless some great miracle happens, they're going to have this difficulty?
Especially since 2000, we've experienced a lot of violence on the ground, where the Israeli army continues to constantly invade, constantly demolish homes, constantly pick up people, put them in jail. So unfortunately, it's been very devastating on the ground in terms of the Israeli army coming in and out of the Palestinian territories basically any time that they wish. And people suffering from these this terrible occupation and oppression that they haven't been able to, although the Israelis continue to steal more and more land and basically have taken everything away from Palestine, just that small willpower continues to exist, where people still keep the hope that freedom can and human rights can come to Palestine. So I think this is the only thing that the Israelis have not been successful at stealing from the individuals. It's just the willpower of the Palestinian individual to hope and to wish for peace and for human rights. But also the settlements, since I've also been living there since the early 90s, just constantly we see more and more settlements go up. So although the Oslo Agreement said a freeze on settlements, the roadmap said a freeze on settlements, the Annapolis talks maybe talk about no more settlements, with our eyes and moving all around Taibeh, where now we have three illegal settlements getting bigger and bigger, we see roads opening up every single day, every single week, and the army comes, flattens out land, and houses go, and illegal outposts continue to go up.
And this is why I admire you and your husband, and especially the work that you're doing to keep people on the ground, to keep that willpower alive and hope that somewhere along the line the world will wake up. And who knows, a new American government, what it will do, but you know, there, the signs are that not much can be done in the near future. So it becomes essential to stay on the ground. But tell me, here you have a housing project, which we've discussed, and anyone who wants to make a contribution can send it to the Metropolis here in Brookline. The address is in Brookline. And then you have the education project, which I would like for us to put the address up on the screen shortly. You also started a lot of this with your own books that you have published for children about their Christian backgrounds and teaching them the way of this. Tell us about this book, because this was how you initiated some of the projects. I mean, you contribute, right, your, any income from this goes to the project.
Right. The net profits from my Christina series go to pay for the church website, to pay for the running costs of running the project. So when people give money to education, it goes straight into the endowment, or housing goes straight for housing. So I,
so there's no overhead.
I volunteer my time 100% to the church. I'm not paid by the church, and I don't get any commissionable amount.
This is St. George's Church.
From St. George Greek Orthodox Church in Taibe. And the Christina books really started with the first book, Christina Goes to Church, when my children were very little, because I just had the need to explain to my own kids, why do people light candles? Why do people kiss the icon? Christina Goes to Church developed this genuine Christian character that wanted to know more about the symbolism in the church. But when I found myself living in Palestine, and Taibe had such rich history in Christian roots, where Christ came into the village right before his crucifixion, and our town is actually biblical Ephraim, but in the 12th century it had the modern name Taibe from the Islamic leader that came into the village.
Salahuddin
called the people Taibin when the Christian people dared to invite him and to feed his horses, and so he said, "You are Taibin people." So
Tell our audience what Taibin means.
Taibin means good.
You're good and sweet people.
And since the 12th century, we've had this the modern name Taibe. But since I found myself living in such a precious place that had rich Christian roots, and St. Helen built the first church in our village and named it after St. George. While she was there for 2 years looking for the cross in Jerusalem, she set up her camp in Taibe. I developed the little Christian character to walk throughout Palestine and walk throughout the holy sites and go where Jesus was born, where Jesus was baptized, where the first miracle happened. And on the last page, actually, the little girl comes to Taibe, so she can, the book can have a message. She will go to her school, she will go to her church, and she will say, Palestinian Christians need help to stay in Palestine, and they need help with these basic things, jobs, housing, education. So Christina Goes to the Holy Land is a virtual pilgrimage of all the beautiful sacred sites that exist there, and we want to keep faithful people there, so the churches are not empty. So when the patriarch comes out on Holy Saturday at the glorious miracle of the Holy Fire, which is just a magnificent celebrated ceremony throughout many centuries in Jerusalem, and he says Christ is risen, we'd actually have some people to receive the Holy Fire and to say, truly, the Lord is risen. And then this year I've tried to appeal to a younger reader by turning the Christina Goes to the Holy Land coloring with Christina into a coloring book, so little children can color Bethlehem, color Jerusalem, but trying to put a seed in children's minds, you know, pray for the Holy Land, pray for peace to come in Palestine, because it is worthy to one day walk these beautiful footsteps and be enriched in the Christian faith. So it's holy to all, Jews, Muslims, and Christians. But since I was born a Greek Orthodox a woman, I'm trying to, through my eyes, present what I see the beauty of the Holy Land to be. And I actually have another book that talks about the suffering and how awful conditions are since I've been living there, and since how that's what I've experienced in the ground, that people, the army is trying to make life so difficult that we just simply don't want to live there anymore, because we can't do simple things just moving around. We suffer from the basic lack of the freedom of movement. So that book, Witness in the Holy Land, is more for adult readers to read what day-to-day, it's like my diary, day-to-day what life is like on the ground.
And all the proceeds from this, as I say, go into your project. Where can people get copies of these books if they wanted to have their children use them, read them, color them?
Right. The Christina series and the Witness in the Holy Land are available from Holy Cross bookstore in Brookline, Massachusetts, at Helena College Holy Cross, and also from St. Nectarios Press in Seattle, Washington. So both of those locations have 800 numbers.
Holy Cross bookstore, which is in Brookline, and that's easy enough for people to remember. You're very fortunate that you have this strong faith, which allows you to endure the situation on a daily basis in Palestine. I must say that I admire the work that you do. Your own personhood is quite amazing. But tell me also a little bit more about daily life in Palestine. The Israelis have worked very hard on trying to separate people, not only from political faction from political faction, but also to separate Christians from Muslims. And it works on fragmenting Palestinians, making it easier for them to try to control them or to give an excuse to say they can't. They're not reliable partners. How are things within the... Do Palestinians succumb, in other words, to these machinations of the Israelis? And do they understand that they are being manipulated and that they're falling prey to their own kind of ego, if you will? Because they are stubborn about finding this consensus. What is your reading on this? Are they really so fragmented? Is there no attempt to get a consensus?
The terrible thing with our communities that have been completely divided is the checkpoints have always made me feel I'm in a psychological prison throughout the many years that I've lived there. But now with the wall being completely finished and built, it's really a physical prison. So obviously, people of any faith, you know, when you simply lock them in, when you take their hope away, when there's hardly any employment, it's obvious that when every single day we're being violated in our rights, violence is going to breed more violence. So unfortunately, although we work so hard in the Christian private schools to teach nonviolent tactics, nonviolent solutions, unfortunately, because every single day we're experiencing violence on the ground.
Yes, of course.
This really,
violence breeds violence.
This really is quite unfortunate.
And yet there is a nonviolent movement in Palestine at some of the wall areas, and internationals also come and join people. So there is some, there is a recognition that nonviolent approach is better.
And the wall now has really completely cut us off from different communities. So for example, we have many people that, you know, if their elderly parents or their grandmother might be in Bethlehem and they might be in Ramallah, it is just so difficult, and they are separated in being able to check on their elderly mother as often as they would if we didn't have these awful checkpoints and the wall. And a lot of people are just simply cut off now from their olive trees and from their cultivating their agricultural lands, because we just have the wall that came between people in the hospital, people in school, people in their lands to cultivate, because the wall just simply went up where Israel wanted to go up. So it just took more Palestinian land and put it on the Israeli side.
And so it's creeping kind of integration, sort of solidifying the area that they control and isolating Palestinians, hoping to squeeze them so they'll leave.
So we're constantly being squeezed in more and more, and it's difficult to host programs where you might want to gather people from Ramallah and people from Bethlehem, because we're so cut off from one another. It's very difficult to have local
physical fragmentation.
It's difficult to have programs and to promote anything, because people just find it so frustrating to travel and to move around, where a 10-minute ride would just take an hour and a half, because of course the settlements have cut off the main road, so we're not allowed to access the main roads that the we have Jewish roads for Jews only, and only the back roads are open for us that are sometimes not paved. They're full of rocks, they're full of holes, they're narrow, they're dangerous roads. But this is the only way, for example, I could move around from Taibe to go to Ramallah, because the settlers have shut off the regular road.
Do you have any patterns, psychological patterns developing among the young at this point?
There's a lot of trauma and traumatic situations where you know, if the army has invaded homes in the middle of the night, you know, searching for someone, children suffer from some of these basic things like bedwetting, or we have many centers in the West Bank and in Gaza trying to deal with the trauma that children have experienced during this awful occupation.
Maria, we're coming to a close of this interview, and I'm wondering if there's anything further that you would like to say to our audience, and then we will put the address for the Education Fund on the screen for people to send donations, and certainly let us encourage them to do so. But is there anything you would like to end with? And anything further you'd like to say?
Well, I wanted to say that the Taibe Oktoberfest this year, we hope that people will pray for us so we can have another successful village festival, because this is a big boost to our economy. And God willing, it'll take place October 11th and 12th, 2008, in Taibe, Palestine. And we hope that people will not forget the holy places and would consider showing the ultimate solidarity and support, and with their presence come and visit and venerate the holy places, because this is just another way for us to keep our community alive and
Are there connected. Hotels that they, hotels in the area they can stay at? They could go online and find these things. I'm trying to see if our people, audience out there, might be interested in going. What can they expect in terms of hotels?
Right. Well, there's official tours that take place. There's Father Elia out of New York every year likes to bring pilgrims to the Holy Land. So locally in Taipei, we have a small guest home that accommodates up to 32 people if they double up in a room. But of course, most people stay in Jerusalem and go out to the different holy sites. But we pray for peace, we pray for democracy and stability so people can continue to come and visit and venerate the holy sites.
Well, I wish you a great deal of luck. You have been doing a marvelous job under the worst circumstances, and we hope that in the end you not only will succeed in keeping people on the ground, but that you will see peace and you will see the area thriving and more pilgrims going there. Thank you for coming
and
being with Arabic Hour.
Yeah, thank you, Elaine. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine, and thank you, Dr. Khoury. We'll be back with a documentary, Right of Return, produced by Alternate Focus after this short program ID.
You are watching The Arabic Hour, a program of news, views, culture, cuisine, and the Arab American experience. To view today's program or any of our previous programs, log on to www.arabic.hour.org.
It was May of 1948. In The Hague, Holland, two former Nazis were sentenced to death for their participation in the slaughter of 6 million Jews. James Michener and Tennessee Williams were awarded the Pulitzer Prize. The United States had exploded an atomic bomb in the South Pacific. Joe DiMaggio hit three consecutive home runs. And the 35-year British mandate over Palestine expired, leading to the establishment of the State of Israel. For Israelis, 1948 was a triumph in their quest for a safe haven from the centuries of persecution, culminating in the Holocaust. But for the Palestinians they displaced, this event is known as Al-Nakba, or the Catastrophe. In America and Europe, popular sympathy for a Jewish state had been growing, and when David Ben-Gurion proclaimed the State of Israel on May 14, 1948, he knew that he had the backing of many governments, including the Soviet Union. But Israel's claim to sovereignty was immediately challenged by the surrounding Arab states, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. And within 24 hours, the ongoing border skirmishes became a full-scale war. The battle was hard-fought in some areas, such as Lod, but the Arab armies were no match for the Israelis. The Jewish militia, the Haganah, quickly defeated the various Arab forces that stood in their way as thousands of terrified Palestinians fled their villages or were forcibly removed by the advancing Israelis. In some villages, the inhabitants were rounded up and executed, and as word of these massacres spread, many more villagers began to leave in panic. Others simply left, believing that they would return to their homes when the fighting was over. Mitri Barghouti, who was 10 years old at the time, describes what happened to his family.
Jews came in and they have asked the people to give up. In other words, not fight. Because if they didn't fight, they would get the same treatment as they did in Lod. Lod, they were resisted the incursion, and they fought hard, but they end up getting massacred, of course, because they are no match to the Jewish people prepared for that war. And a group of people went to the Jews, to say, okay, we'll give up, we're not gonna fight, like a doctor and a mayor and a group of people. So finally I said, okay, you raise the flag and bring all the people into the church, the Catholic church. And it happens to be where I used to go in school, in the elementary school. Father Julio used to be, he's a monk. And he used to be my teacher as well. So they they started calling everybody to go to church. They went to church. Then the Israeli man, a military man, stood out with Abuna Julio, with Father Julio, and he told the people, and I believe it was Ishaq Rabin. I'm not too sure, but I believe he was him. He says, okay, you go home, carry what you can with your hand, and stand on the street early in the morning, because the buses are going to take you east to go to Jordan. And everybody went home. They put two or three clothes changes on their body, because they couldn't carry everything. Some people carried water, some people carried food. My mother used to have twins, 10 days old twins. One of them is still alive. The other one died 10 days later. Then they put everybody on buses and trucks and carts and everything, and they drove them as far as they could east to go to Jordan. And they said, that's the way, go east. And some people who could walk, they walked in 2 days, they were there. But some people, like my mother at the time with a twin, 10 days old twin, they couldn't walk fast enough. So it took them a week before they got there.
But what caused a land where people of many ethnicities had lived in relative harmony for centuries to become divided in violence, a violence that persists to this day? To answer this question, we must first examine the history of the region up to the United Nations plan for the partition of Palestine in 1947. From the first century, current era onward, Palestine, particularly the area known as the Holy Land, has been under one foreign occupation after another. Jews, Christians, and Muslims made up the indigenous population. With the spread of Islam, Muslim Arabs predominated. Meanwhile, after centuries of persecution, a nationalist movement arose among the Jewish communities in Europe and in Russia. The ambition of this group, who called themselves Zionists, was to redeem the land of Palestine as the inalienable possession of the Jewish people. And in 1882, the first contingent of 25,000 Zionist settlers arrived in Palestine with the assistance of the French. In the first decade of the 20th century, with a world war brewing in Europe and Asia Minor, 40,000 more Jewish immigrants joined the ranks of the Zionist settlers. During the war, the Turks were driven out of Palestine by the British and their Arab allies. And in 1916, the area was divided into provinces under British and French control. A year later, the British government issued the Balfour Declaration. It proposed a Jewish homeland in Palestine, under a British administration. However, the idea was opposed by the First Palestinian National Congress in 1917, as well as many prominent Jewish leaders in Europe who predicted that much trouble could come from such a venture. But why shouldn't Jews have a homeland? Dr. Jess Ganan explains the difficulties.
It's a very good question. It's a very complex question. And if you look at the way the question is asked, it says, why shouldn't Jews have a homeland? It doesn't say, why should Jews have a state? And, you know, given that we live in the 21st century and we're coming out of the 20th century, it should be really obvious that Jews do have many homelands, just as Christians have many homelands, just as Muslims have many homelands, and that the idea that there should be privileged homeland for one religious group over another religious group really smacks of racism. And that, you know, in this era, in the modern era, the way we're kind of confronting, you know, what the world is presenting right now in terms of war, social injustice, bigotry, hatred, and racism, we can no longer tolerate a kind of ideology or a kind of racism that says that one kind of group, whether it be based on religious or other kinds of perspectives, is privileged over another group. So I would say, you know, it's clear that Muslims, that Christians, and Jews have many kinds of homelands. And it should be guaranteed. And in fact, if you look at the current demography of the distribution of Jews, Christians, and Muslims all over the world, people are distributed, they live, they work, they function all over the world. When you start talking about a privileged, a special place for one religious group over another, based on some sort of religious ideology, again, that smacks of a certain kind of racism, which we cannot tolerate anymore. And that's why the concept of a state, so to speak, for one religious group exclusively over another cannot be tolerated in the modern era, or in any era for that matter.
The colonization of Palestine continued after the war. From 1919 to 1923, another 35,000 Jewish immigrants came to the region, increasing their population to 12%. The conditions now existed for two competing nationalist aspirations under the rule of a foreign power. During the 1920s, in an effort to confront an Arab majority that was becoming increasingly wary of the growing Jewish influence, Jewish militants formed an underground militia known as the Haganah, or Self-Defense Force. From 1924 to 1939, the rise of fascism in Europe produced an accelerated influx of Jews, bringing the total Jewish population in Palestine up to 30%. Throughout the 1930s, sporadic violence erupted between the Arab population, Jewish settlers, and the British security forces, claiming the lives of over 500 Jews and 2,000 Arabs. During World War II, some 60,000 Jews fleeing Hitler managed to seek refuge in Palestine, and by the end of the war they had created a militia of over 65,000 men, and guerrilla groups, such as the Stern Gang, were targeting the British administration with bombings and assassinations. As their mandate in Palestine was about to expire, the British sought help from the newly formed United Nations to create a solution to the impending crisis in Palestine. And in 1947, a UN plan to partition Palestine into Jewish and Arab sectors was passed by a vote of 33-14, with 10 abstentions. The Arab delegates walked out. Under this plan, UN Resolution 181, 57% of Palestine, mostly desert, was assigned to Jews, with the remaining 43% given over to Arabs. But the terms of Resolution 181 implied that the existing populations in each area had the right to remain and become citizens of the respective states, regardless of their ethnicity, and could not be coerced into leaving against their will. It even went on to say that Palestinian citizens shall, upon the recognition of independence, become citizens of the state in which they are resident and enjoy full civil and political rights. Persons over the age of 18 years may opt, within 1 year from the date of recognition of independence of the state in which they reside, for citizenship of the other state. Vehemently opposed to the partition of Palestine, the Arabs began to form their own militias, and neighboring Arab states readied their troops as the British forces prepared for departure. The stage was now set for a battle that would lead to the creation of the State of Israel in May of 1948. And the displacement of over 750,000 Palestinians as refugees. In the wake of the massive exodus of Palestinians from Israel, the UN General Assembly passed Resolution 194 in December of 1948, establishing the right of return for refugees. The US was one of the 35 countries voting for it. Resolution 194 resolves that the refugees wishing to return to their homes and live in peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest practicable date, and that compensation should be paid for the property of those choosing not to return, and for the loss of or damage to property which, under principles of international law or inequity, should be made good by the governments or authorities responsible.
Israel does not agree to give any compensation for any refugee. It's a principal question for Israel. It was a principal question in the negotiations. Israel does not accept the principle of compensation, of course not the principle of return. You know, the principle of return is a demographic issue. It's totally rejected by Israel, although you know, it was drafted by the United States, the right of return. Many people forget it, that it was a resolution suggested by the United States 194 and the United Nations. Anyway, Israel rejects the right of return and the compensation, because the notion of compensation means that Israel accepts the responsibility.
From the outset, Israel did not acknowledge responsibility for the refugees. In 1949, Mr. Iban told the UN that the problem of the Arab refugees was a direct consequence of the war launched by the Arab states, which were entirely responsible for that, as well as for other forms of suffering inflicted by that war, and that it was wrong to describe the refugees as having been driven out. Rather, they had fled in an atmosphere of fear, insecurity, and danger inseparable from war. Nevertheless, as a condition for its membership in the UN, Israel announced its acceptance of obligations to make compensation for abandoned lands, and gave a tentative acceptance of Resolution 194 by declaring that Israel did not exclude the possibility of a measure of repatriation. During more than 50 years since the resolution was passed, no Palestinian refugee has ever been repatriated. We ask Jessica Nan to explain why.
You know, the right of return is not a new concept, and it's not necessarily new at all for Palestinians, or specific to Palestinians, rather. It's a concept that actually has a very long history. It's a concept that applies to lots of different groups, and even in the relatively recent modern era, we have lots of examples of refugees being afforded the right to return to their homes. More recently, for example, there are examples after the war in Afghanistan, Afghan refugees were allowed to return home. In Bosnia, refugees were allowed to return home. And there are just literally hundreds of examples that after warlike conditions or the actual consequences of war where a refugee problem has been committed, and refugees are guaranteed and afforded the right to return to their homes. So it seems rather remarkable that all these examples where refugees are allowed to return to their homes historically for you know, as long as we have recorded history, but for some reason Palestinian refugees are excluded from that kind of right, that kind of inalienable right, that non-negotiable right. For some reason, it seems like Palestinians have never been afforded that right, even though all these other refugees have had that opportunity to return to their homes. And there's three places within international law that guarantee a refugee's right, and specifically the Palestinian right to return to their homes. There's the International Declaration of Human Rights, which guarantees that refugees can return to their homes. There's the Geneva Convention, which governs the action of, the actions of the consequences of war, basically during war and after war, which guarantees that Palestinians and the refugees have a right to return. And then there's UN Resolution 194, of which Israel is a signatory to, which guarantees that Palestinian refugees at the earliest possible time should be afforded the right to return to their homes. So it's not just to the country of origin, it's specifically to the village and home of origin. And so we have it basically enshrined at three levels of international law that the Palestinian right of return is guaranteed.
Dr. Ganan compares the Palestinian right of return to the Jewish law of return, which grants all Jews the right to settle in Israel.
The Jewish law of return is actually quite disturbing if we kind of look at it dispassionately. And what it basically says is that a Jew anywhere in the world has the right to return to the state of Israel, irrespective of their birth history, irrespective of their ethnicity, irrespective of whatever historical trajectory that they themselves have been. And it has gotten even to the more ludicrous level, where recently a 400 Peruvian indigenous Indians were brought into Israel, into settlements in the West Bank, who were converted essentially a month before their arrival. These were indigenous native Peruvian Indians who had been converted to Christianity, who were going through very stark poverty conditions in Peru, and who were given this opportunity by the government of Israel to actually come into West Bank settlements if they converted to Judaism, which they did. Now that, in my mind, seems bizarre, because here we have indigenous Peruvian Indians coming to Palestine and having the right to go into a settlement on Palestinian land, and I, as a Palestinian, have no right to do that. It seems rather bizarre that, again, one religious group is privileged over another and is afforded the right to return to a land for which they have no connection to. Yet a Palestinian, like myself, whether they're Christian or Muslim, has no right at this point to return to their home. And frankly, that just seems like naked racism to me. And it's part of this racist structure that the state of Israel is built on, where one group is privileged over another. There are color problems, also, because if you look at the kind of racism that exists in Israel right now, there's a deep kind of racist divide between Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship, Palestinian Arabs who are Christians and Muslims who are treated as fourth-class citizens, and then you have this whole kind of color spectrum within Israel, like Ethiopian or black Jews, for example, are treated horrifically and kind of ghettoized, much like African Americans have been ghettoized in the United States and throughout the world. And at the top of the privilege heap are basically white European Jews. And so you have the same racist structure that this country, the United States, had to confront during the civil rights era, which we still confront, is endemic within Israel right now. And in my mind, this idea of like the law of return based on a religious ideology is rather ridiculous. I mean, I would ask people to kind of think about it. What would happen in the United States, for example, if we said only Christians could come to the United States? It would be ridiculous. It just doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. And I think it's time that people confronted this kind of exclusionary structure that exists right now, this kind of racism that exists, and it's time to really confront this head on. Notwithstanding the guarantee of Palestinian and all refugees the right to return home based on international law, we also have this kind of given inalienable right that an individual Palestinian refugee or any refugee has to return to their home, and no treaty, no government can sign away that individual inalienable right. So we see that refugees, and specifically Palestinian refugees, in terms of their right to return to their homes, are supported by both international law, which guarantees it, as well as this inalienable individual right that a specific refugee has. The complexities involved with compensation are truly, it's a very complex issue for many reasons. Specifically, the issue of compensation typically gets looked at as either compensation in lieu of the right of return or in exchange for the right of return, when in fact, with contemporary analyses, the way we really look at it is that there should be compensation in addition to the right of return. In other words, it's an individual choice of the specific refugee or refugee family. I mean, if a Palestinian refugee is afforded their right to return to their home, not only should they be given that right, but they should also be afforded compensation. If someone chooses not to return to their home, that's a different equation in terms of compensatory, in terms of compensation or any kind of compensatory analysis. So
that's all the time we have today. Thank you for watching. Please join us next week for another edition of the Arabic Hour. On behalf of all the volunteers here, I am Luay Jindi, wishing you a happy week.
The Arabic Hour has been brought to you in part by the William G. Abdullah Memorial Library, a resource center for information and education on the Arab-American experience. The American Arabic Benevolent Association, an umbrella organization for community endeavors. The Nicholas G. Barham Veterans Association and Ladies Auxiliary, providing veteran services, scholarships with community pride, and by our members, as well as contributions by viewers like you.